And before the opening of the election,
can you just
be cornered?
Yes, one, two, three, and there.
Okay, because we have time pressure. I will be very strict on time allocation in terms of your presentations, so that we give everybody a fair chance to give us a presentation and we have ample time and space for engagement. Now, let me ask Justice for, what? Cross for Justice to give us a presentation for 10 minutes, and then I propose, if honorable members allows me that space, that we take all the presentation, and then after that we have a holistic engagement on the presentations. Can we employ that approach, honorable members? Cause for Justice, give us a presentation. Time is 10 past 10. 20 past, you should be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If I may, this is a request. Seeing as the program originally catered for 5 presenters and it's been reduced to 3, would it be possible to extend the time period for presentations?
No, I'm saying the presentation, give us 10 minutes presentation.
Thank you.
And what is important is the engagement emanating from the presentation. And you can highlight key issues, strategic issues, which capture the tenor of your presentation and will engage. What is important is the engagement and the outcome.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair, honourable members, committee staff, parliamentary officials and staff, fellow presenters, fellow citizens and members of the public present. Today I would like to speak on South Africa's response to one of the biggest public health crises faced by our nation. In the United States, a country which is synonymous with the production of sexually explicit material, 10 state legislatures have already in short succession passed resolutions declaring pornography a public health crisis. The two main concerns that we highlight is firstly the lowering of the bar on what material may not be distributed in South Africa at all, and secondly the proposed legalizing of online adult pornography to adult internet users. For starters, I'd just like to refer to our table of contents for our presentation. Secondly, the layout of our written submission, which we provided to the committee before the deadline set for it early in September. So that will be the full exposition of our presentation. Then, regarding the background to Cause for Justice, I refer you merely to our written submissions, paragraphs 4 to 8. And then also to note that we now have at least 60 individuals who sent in submissions directly to the committee, also citing our main concerns and supporting our proposals in respect thereof. To lay down a basis for a discussion about freedom of expression and pornography, which is explicit expression, when I look at the Constitutional Court in the Derriot matter, where it said that the limitation of pornography does not implicate the core values of the right, which is the freedom of expression right. And also pornography is for the most part expression of little value, which is found on the periphery of the right. Next, just looking at the German position, South Africa gets its jurisprudence on human dignity mainly from Germany. Canada also adopted it from the Germans. And just reading there from the highlighted part, the court essentially asks whether the material presents the characters truly as human beings with a value in and of themselves. If the material does, the court will find the sexual explicitness acceptable because sex forms a natural part of life. If, on the other hand, the material basically employs its characters only as objects for other purposes, notably sexual stimulation, the court will find the depiction of sex unacceptable because the work treats the characters not as humans, but only as objects. Such a work denies the characters their human individuality and personhood. The approach of the German courts thus concerns itself not with the viewer's prurient interest, but ultimately with human dignity. Then, looking specifically at the proposals in the amendment bill, I refer there in the second column on your screen, you will see the changes that is proposed. So on the left-hand side, you find what is currently in the Act dealing with matters that explicit sexual conduct which violates or shows disrespect for the human dignity of a person, conduct that is degrading of human beings, and also conduct or an act which incites or encourages or promotes harmful behavior. The proposal is to remove all of that and replace it with a single additional element, which is the part which says explicit sexual conduct accompanied by explicit violence. So that added accompanied by explicit violence. We say the consequences of this proposal is that more vile, degrading and dehumanizing materials will now become legally distributable. The position proposed is that it will be fine to distribute such materials as long as it does not contain explicit violence, no matter how degrading and how dehumanizing the material is on its face. Also, we say that the material inciting harm will also become legally distributable. We give examples of what this will mean in practice in our written submissions, paragraph 18. We cite things like the defecating and urinating on a human being, which ostensibly might look like someone is consenting to that being done to them, and we feel that that is problematic. So the question that the department and also the committee has to answer is, why would we want to set the bar so low? Why legalize the distribution of material containing all manner of paraphilic disorders, including necrophilia, coprophilia and urophilia? Why allow people to be degraded and dehumanized in media content? I've run ahead of myself just to make that point about what this material is and what we are looking at, what we are considering. The second point, the second main concern is around the legalizing of the online distribution of pornography. And then we say one of the consequences is that the research shows that one of the causes of adults perpetrating sexual violence on vulnerable individuals, mostly women and children, is actually being exposed to adult pornography. Talking about non-violent adult pornography as one of its results, one of its consequences is that people go out and they perpetrate sexual violence on vulnerable people. And this is proposed without first conducting an investigation into the costs for society of actually making this change to the law. If it is accepted, it will become legally, okay, that's a part I've already spoken on. So what we're saying is, and I'm returning for the moment to the definition of material that may not be distributed in South Africa at all, right? This is the XX definition, and the proposed amendments to only include a bar on things that contains explicit violence. We've asked the question, why would we allow people to be degraded and dehumanized in media content? Then we say the scope of legitimate exercise of constitutional freedoms does not extend to the use of such freedoms to violate human dignity and placing people at risk of harm and exploitation. That would constitute an abuse of constitutional freedoms. To put it more bluntly, freedom has not been given in order to trample on or violate people's inherent dignity. We also have a reference to the print media judgment, which is something that has come up in the last 2.5 years while this bill has been in Parliament. There is a majority judgment which said that the wording we are dealing with and that is proposed to be deleted is not vague and overbroad. There's a minority judgment who found that the words might be vague and overbroad, but then proposes a remedy. And the remedy is there must be a substantial redrafting of the legislative text. So what we say is if we water down the XX definition, the result will be the violation of the inherent dignity of people and or degrading people, in that materials containing such depictions will be legally distributed or sold. And we're also saying a public health and safety risk will result from people who will be allowed to distribute material to incite recipients to harm others or themselves. Our proposal is therefore, either leave the provisions of the Act untouched, so don't accept the proposed amendments. This would be in line with the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court in the print media case and will still allow any interpretational shortcomings to be addressed in the Film and Publications Board's classification guidelines. Alternatively, redraft the provisions to bring it in line with the constitutional norms and values, as was proposed by the minority in the print media case, and we provided a proposed starting point for such a redrafting exercise in Annexure D to our written submissions. Then we move on to the legalization of the proposed legalizing of online distribution of hardcore pornography to adults. And what we've already said is that the research shows non-violent adult pornography viewed by adults is a cause of sexual aggression and gender-based violence. And this is borne out by the research. We list the 3 points, which is observances we make in South African society. Pornography use is rife in South Africa. We are in the top 20 of all countries in the world. Gender-based domestic and sexual violence is rife in South Africa. We received the stats again yesterday. Scientific or research evidence shows that pornography use is a cause of gender-based violence. And I will read one example.
I want to give you 5 minutes extra. I spend about 10 now.
Around 5 minutes. Thank you, Chen.
Thank you.
One example of the research that has been done, and it is cited on your screen, I will just read the highlighted parts. So, there was a study done, a meta-analysis, about sexual violence, pornography use and sexual violence. They looked at 22 studies covering 7 countries, and they found pornography use and acts of sexual aggression were directly connected. Violent pornography was even more strongly linked to sexual violence. The weight of the evidence shows the direction of the connection clearly. The available research shows that pornography causes gender-based violence. All right, so if we move on, I would say if we had to take stock of what the proposal is before Parliament and what the research shows, it shows that non-violent adult pornography is a poison and violent adult pornography is even more toxic. The question is, does that provide a rational justification for prohibiting the distribution of the one but legalizing the other? We don't think so. Poison at the end is still poison. So the harms that is borne out by the research, and specifically this one, is a cause for serious concern and warrants proper investigation. The sales on the bill did not look at the social and economic impact of legalizing the mass distribution of adult pornography to adults via the internet. If the legislative proposal is accepted, it will be done without having investigated to determine what the cost of that decision will be. According to the research, more vulnerable people, mostly women and children, will fall prey to, in most circumstances, adult male sexual predators. To take the decision to legalize without having given proper consideration to the research and the impact it will have is to declare deviant male sexual entertainment is more important than the safety and protection of women and children. That would be a travesty of justice. If, for example, in case law, which you can go look at afterwards, the case of State versus Engelbrecht, we had the UCT rape spree in late 2016. So our proposal in respect of the proposed legalizing of online pornography is conduct or commission an official and credible investigation into the effects of adult pornography on South African society before we take any legislative action to change the status quo. In the interim, keep the current licensed adult premises regime intact, because it still strikes a constitutionally justifiable balance between protection from harm and protection of human dignity on the one hand and freedom of expression on the other. Again, the question that needs to be answered: how can we, knowing that exposure to non-violent adult pornography results in men, and I will add the caveat, it results in some men, not all men, perpetrating sexual violence on women and children, how can we then support the mass online distribution thereof into our society as a matter of state policy and of law, and especially without first conducting an investigation to count the cost of such decision? The rest of our submissions, Chair, is available to you on our slide deck and of course also in our detailed written submissions, but we'll conclude with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you welcome the department, leading the delegation from the department?
It is me, Chetan.
Well, Kamala Kumban.
Chetan?
Kamamban. Your name?
Oh, I'm Seo. Seo Harabia.
Okay, good. You're more welcome. And let's welcome our legal department of government.
General, we are also with the FPP team,
okay,
together with the council members of FPP.
Yeah,
thank you.
We are all welcome. Okay. Let's go to the next presentation. Freedom of religion.
We are having some technical difficulties. If that happened, someone in the room could assist us. Yeah.
Chair, Honourable Chair, Members of Parliament, or Protocols Observed, my name is Advocate Nadine Bardenhorst and I am the Legal Counsel of Freedom of Religion South Africa, also known as 4SA. 4SA is an NPC and we serve to protect and promote the constitutional right to religious freedom in South Africa. We represent a constituency of approximately 6 million people from different faiths in South Africa. And our concern in relation to the bill today relates primarily to the proposed definition of hate speech in the bill. With regards to the remainder of the bill, we would affirm and rest with the submissions made by Calls for Justice just now So my focus will be on the definition of hate speech. Chair, our primary concerns are that the proposed definition of hate speech in the bill is firstly overbroad and therefore an impermissible limitation on freedom of speech, and for that reason potentially unconstitutional. And secondly, that the current definition in the bill could have a major chilling effect on freedom of speech, including therefore religious speech. I would also at this stage like to point out that, as we know, there's also a definition of hate speech in the Equality Act, also known as the PUDA. That definition also goes wider than the Constitution definition of hate speech, as I'll explain just now, and for that very reason, there's a challenge at the moment before the Supreme Court of Appeal in Bloemfontein to the definition of hate speech in the Equality Act. And the point that I'm making is simply this, that this committee needs to be very careful in straying further than what the Constitution is and what the Constitution allows, or otherwise it might open itself up to the very same challenge as applies to the definition of hate speech in the Equality Act, which is currently before the Supreme Court of Appeal. So the starting point then is the Constitution. Section 16 of the Constitution specifically, which protects the right to freedom of expression, a very important, exceptionally important right in our Constitution, particularly as it is one of the bedrocks, the cornerstones of a democratic society, the ability to freely speak one's mind and one's opinion. So it's a very broad right that enjoys extensive protection, and really the only limitations in terms of the Constitution on freedom of expression is there set out in subsection 2, which says that the right to freedom of expression does not extend to 1, propaganda for war, 2, incitement of imminent violence, and then 3 is what we would generally refer to as hate speech, and it is defined in the Constitution as such. The advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. So both elements need to be present. On the one hand, an advocacy of hatred, and secondly, it needs to constitute incitement to cause harm, and I'll refer to that in a moment. Now, if we compare the current definition of the bill to the definition of hate speech in the Constitution, immediately it is evident from Section 1K that the definition is much broader, much wider. It reads as follows. Hate speech includes any speech, gesture, conduct, writing, display, or publication made using the internet, which is prohibited in terms of Section 16(2) of the Constitution, and then importantly, which propagates, advocates, or communicates words against any person or identifiable group, so not restricting it to the grounds in the Constitution, which words could reasonably be construed to demonstrate a clear intention to be harmful, to incite harm, and promote or propagate hatred against a said person or identifiable group. And then those are the related sections in the bill that also refer to this definition of hate speech. And importantly, throws in some other elements, or it's not consistent in the bill where hate speech is referred to, that it's always the same elements that are required. So let's quickly compare. Hate speech in terms of the Constitution requires, as I said, an advocacy of hatred. Now, how that has been interpreted by our courts is what's called for is a calling for and making a case for hatred, not the mere communication of words as required by the bill. There needs to be a stirring up, a persuasion towards taking an attitude of hatefulness towards certain groups, not mere the communication of words as required by the bill. So the bill sets a much lower threshold for hate speech than what is required by the Constitution. Secondly, in terms of the Constitution, as I pointed out, it must be on the listed grounds, namely race, ethnicity, gender and religion, versus the bill's unrestricted scope, which says any person, any identifiable group. So it's really just throws it as the net as wide as one can possibly imagine, and I would submit that it's unconstitutional. Thirdly, I pointed out that in terms of the Constitution, in order to qualify as hate speech, both elements need to be present. It needs to be an advocacy of hatred, and secondly, that constitutes incitement to cause harm. In other words, there needs to be a stirring up towards hatred and then say, now go do something about it. Go cause this person or this group harm. An incitement to cause harm. And that has been interpreted by the courts as a pressing or a stirring up of someone to act in a violent or physically harmful manner. When we look at the bill's threshold, however, or the qualification of hate speech, it's quite a different test. So we see this incitement to cause harm in terms of the Constitution, it's an objective test. How would a person who listens to the speech sitting in the audience hear it? Do they hear it as, you are not calling people to go out and cause harm to a certain audience? It's an objective test. Whereas what the bill is doing, it's rather confusing in a sense with respect, because it seems to incorporate somewhat of a combined test, a subjective inquiry, but also married with an objective inquiry. Why do I say that? Let's just go back for a moment. So it says, which words could reasonably be construed. So that seems to imply an objective test. How would a reasonable person listening to the speech hear it? Reasonably be construed to demonstrate a clear intention. But there we're back to a subjective inquiry. What was the intention of the speaker? To be harmful, to incite harm, and promote or propagate hatred. So as I say, we have this kind of hybrid of a subjective and an objective inquiry, which makes it very difficult from a legal certainty point of view, both for the public who needs to know what kind of speech would be criminalized, what kind of speech is not allowed by the law, and indeed those who need to enforce the law, to know what is the test that actually applies for hate speech. Because hate speech is a radical erosion, essentially, of freedom of speech, and therefore it needs to be a high threshold. We can't just have any speech, any communication of words that people could potentially find unfavorable or offensive, now classified as hate speech. As we know, the Constitution does not protect people against offensive speech. It protects people against hate speech, and we shouldn't confuse those two. So firstly, as I pointed out, the problem that we have is the hate speech definition in the bill goes much broader than the Constitution. It's overbroad and therefore potentially unconstitutional. The second concern that we have relating to the definition of hate speech relates to the potential chilling effect on freedom of speech and also therefore religious speech. Now, as I said, the right to free speech is an exceptionally important one in the Constitution, particularly for you as honourable members of Parliament also to have the right to say what it is you believe, what you believe from a scriptural point of view, what you believe from a political point of view, to voice your opinion. It's exceptionally important for us to retain that right in democracy. Now, while the Constitution clearly prohibits hate speech, it does not prohibit speech which individuals or groups may find unfavourable or offensive. For instance, holy texts from the Bible or the Quran or other potential religious texts. As we know, there is an anti-religious tide that is sweeping South Africa, that is sweeping the West, and increasingly we find people who drive an anti-religion agenda wanting to silence people of faith and saying that particular religious texts, particularly those that speak to issues of sexual morality, are archaic and politically incorrect and for that reason should be outlawed. Now the problem is that the current definition of hate speech in the bill could potentially be used, or it could have the effect of muzzling believers across the different faiths from expressing their sincerely held religious convictions and beliefs, which may well be considered harmful by people, as I said, who drive an anti-religion agenda. I just want to zone in on that a bit. As a result of the current definition of hate speech in the bill, believers would be placed in the impossible situation of exercising a choice between obeying their religious convictions or beliefs, on the one hand, or obeying the law with a threat of punishment in the form of financial penalties or even possible criminalization, should they choose to obey their religious convictions rather than the law. No person should ever have to exercise such an unconscionable choice, and the state, as a protector and defender of the Constitution, Parliament also, should protect its citizens from having to do so. Let me make it plain what I'm saying. By way of example, should the current definition of hate speech in the bill be left unaltered, activists who drive an anti-religion agenda will no doubt rely on this prohibition of hate speech, which is so wide, to target religious groups and people of faith in an effort to stop or hinder the publishing, whether it's in print form or online, through internet or social media, of content of a religious nature, which they could regard as unfavorable, offensive, or intending to be harmful. to people who don't share those religious convictions. And this is already happening in overseas. You might be surprised to know that recently there was a person in the UK who was preaching on the street corner that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to him, or no one comes to the Father except through Jesus. And that was regarded as hate speech in Britain. And it was said that kind of rhetoric, that kind of speech, has no place in modern-day Britain. In modern-day Britain, that was founded on the values of Christianity. And that person was actually prosecuted, and a criminal case was opened up against him, simply because he said what most Christians for thousands of years would hold to, that is really a core tenet of Christianity. So in fact, should the current definition of hate speech in the bill be left unaltered? Those who oppose a Christian worldview will potentially use that very definition to argue that the Bible contains scriptures relating to sexual immorality, for instance, which are unfavorable, offensive, or intending to be harmful to them or to their cause. As such, it could be argued that the Bible contains hate speech and is therefore prohibited in terms of the Act from being printed, distributed, or published online in South Africa. And the same argument could, of course, apply to the Quran or any other holy text. Now, members of Parliament, I understand that this is an extreme example, but it explains the unintended and absurd consequences that the definition in its current form could have, and which I'm sure we would all agree could certainly never have been the intention of this Act and of this committee. So what is our recommendation? We submit that the presumably unintended but nonetheless unconstitutional consequences of the definition of hate speech in its current form can be avoided or eliminated by defining hate speech in the bill exactly as it is defined in section 16.2 of the Constitution. So in the context of the bill, what that would look like is to amend the definition of hate speech to read as follows. Hate speech includes any speech, gesture, conduct, writing, display, publication, so using the same words as is already there, using the internet, but then we amend it to say which amounts to the advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. That would protect us against any potential challenges based on the constitutionality or potential unconstitutionality of this provision, as I reminded already at the beginning of my presentation, that the equality core definition also goes further than the Constitution, and that very definition is currently before the Supreme Court of Appeal for the same reasons, the submission being made that it is unconstitutional for being overbroad and having a major chilling effect on religious freedom. So we need to be very careful in crafting this definition to not open us up to constitutional challenges. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You
have
good on time. You are left with 4 minutes. Thank you for your presentation. Let's call the third presentation ACM.
Philip Rosenthal speaking from Association of Christian Media.
We believe everybody is in possession of this document. Members and the officials and everybody in the house. So you are not going to be like an overhead projector?
No.
You're going to talk to the hard copy?
Yes.
You've got 15 minutes.
Okay. Just to introduce, the Association of Christian Media includes 4 TV broadcasters, 30 radio stations, and 15 content providers, and a number of other organizations providing content towards media. The principal concern that we have is similar to what was raised by the previous presenter, which is the definition of hate speech, which we believe is overbroad, and I will start off by presenting an alternative definition which we would be happy with, and not that we are opposed to the prohibition of real hate speech, but we're just concerned that controversial speech can be construed as hate speech, and thus there can be a chilling of a proper debate in the society. So our alternative definition, which we would like to propose, is advocacy of hatred, and that is not hate speech, but advocacy of hatred. As the previous speaker said, advocacy implies a persistence and an intent rather than just a casual statement. So advocacy of hatred means support for or recommendation of a particular cause or policy made using the internet through speech, gesture, conduct, writing, display, or publication that is based on race, ethnicity, or religion and constitutes incitement to cause harm. Now, in putting forward that alternative proposal, we have tried to keep it as similar as possible to what is already in the bill, but to just narrow it slightly, and the words, the way in which it's narrowed may not seem significant in the sentence, but in terms of the way that it can be interpreted in court, it is very different. And what I have also got here is a separate document in which I explain how we came to that particular proposal. So now we'll go into the detail of the comments. Firstly, we previously raised on the previous 2016 version of this FPB bill four concerns, and three of those concerns we believe have been greatly improved, which we appreciate, which is the, but we would nevertheless highlight it because there could be changes to this bill and somebody may bring some other issues that are relevant. That was firstly just that in terms of broadcasters streaming, they only wish to answer to one complaints authority and not to two complaints authorities. Secondly, in terms of news reporting, the broadcasters that provide digital news are not exempted from Section 16 of the bill, and also citizen journalism is not exempted because they're not members of the press club. And then there's also the issue of how one regulates user-generated content, and we do acknowledge there is an improvement in this bill. But when I think those issues also are affected by the definition of hate speech and harm, because complaints can be brought against the user-generated content and the citizen journalism and the digital content that's provided there on that definition. So the definition of hate speech is very important. Now, certainly we do not want to defend advocacy of hatred as is clearly defined by the Constitution, and we would agree with the definition of hate, advocacy of hatred that is in the Constitution. But what we have found is that there are special interest groups that would like to silence anybody who disagrees with them, and so what they do is that they construe controversial opposing viewpoints as hate speech, and that we've seen including on issues of sexuality, on issues of marriage, on the sanctity of life, or on comparative religion. And we believe we need to continue to have an open debate on these issues. There's been an enormous number of complaints relating to alleged hate speech, which we do not believe is genuine hate speech, which have been put to the Human Rights Commission, the Commission of Gender Equality, the broadcasters, and these tend to have a chilling effect on free speech. Now, the risk is that with this bill, there are now criminal sanctions for hate speech, which is much, much more serious than simply a fine or a prohibition or a takedown, because that can put potentially somebody in jail, and so they might want to be more than inclined to just be quiet, whereas if it's a fine, the company takes the liability, and so that's a different thing. Now, the issues that that we suggest to narrow the definition of hate speech, firstly, that suggests a change definition. Secondly, all references to hate speech be changed to advocacy of hatred, which is the word that is in the Constitution, rather than hate speech itself, so that we do not confuse somebody who just gets angry and makes a casual statement with advocacy, which is a persistent and intended agenda. then the definition of harm regarding hate speech should be preferably left undefined, which puts it as similar to the dictionary definition, or narrowly defined. The current suggested definition, which is in the bill at the moment, is very broad. It's got harm as meaning emotional, psychological, or moral distress. Now, I'm afraid sometimes I get more psychologically distressed about opposing viewpoints, but I don't think that they should be banned. And then the fourth, the criminal sanctions should be removed from the bill, and that should be left to other legislation, preferably under the Department of Justice, which can include the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill, the Intimidation Act, which I think has much tighter controls for processing of criminal issues. Then, in terms of the definition that is currently there, even without the request to change it, I believe that it is not legally correct the way that it is currently phrased in the bill, because there is a it says that the, as it is at the moment, the way it's phrased is that it says which is prohibited in terms of the section 16.2 of the Constitution, or that section 16.2 of the Constitution doesn't actually prohibit anything. All it does is fail to protect that. So that would need to be rephrased. And then it says here, propagates, advocates, or communicates. Now, we would take out the word propagates and communicates and just leave advocates. And then there's the words could reasonably be construed. Now, the difficulty is that you can reasonably construe your opponent's viewpoint very easily as hatred, and that is what is being done. There's literally thousands of complaints that are being put into the Human Rights Commission of people who are offended by something, and then they construe that as hate speech, and we don't want that to then be linked with the criminal sanction. Particularly concerned about the John Colani case, which is where there's currently an appeal, where we believe there was a wrongful finding of the lower court, but that puts then a danger that free speech in general in this country could be very severely narrowed. And so we would advocate this alternative proposal, which I will repeat, which is advocacy of hatred means support for or recommendation of a particular cause or policy made using the internet through speech, gesture, conduct, writing, or publication that is based on race, ethnicity, or gender and constitutes incitement to cause harm. Now really, all that I've done there is that I have taken what is already in the bill and I've combined it with the Oxford Dictionary definition of advocacy and the constitutional definition of the type of speech that it doesn't protect, and I believe that that would separate controversial speech from actual advocacy of hatred.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, the members here at the presentation unloaded before you as members of parliament. I want to give the floor to members of parliament to comment, make inputs, ask questions on the basis of what has been presented before us. Honorable Smith, Honorable Nyanbidi, Honorable Sfaku.
Thank you, Acting Chair. On the presentation for SA, on the proposed definition of hate speech, there's a specific portion that is not included there, and that is sexual orientation, which we see in South Africa a lot of violence towards people of different sexual orientations. So that's not included in that. And I understand that it's not part of the Constitution, which is already a question, but in terms of, because all the others, race, ethnicity, gender, religion, and sexual orientation all fall within the same space. So that's maybe a proposal that I'll make, for that also to be included in that. that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all the presentations. Well, my first question has been covered by Honorable Smith. The first one is to freedom of religion. The issue of your membership, maybe a little bit of elaboration. You talk, you spoke of 6 million. To have card-carrying members, how do you arrive to that number so that we can be sure as a select committee, because the issue of public participation is our core mandate and it's very important. So we highly appreciate, especially when there are people coming in front of us and they are representing a number of people. My second question is to almost all the presenters. It's in relation to the citation or the you are referring us to the John Kwelane case. Don't you think maybe it's depriving us an opportunity to be able to do injustice in dealing with the matter, because it's an issue that is still at the SCA, and you might find that the outcome of the SCA, it can still go to Concord. Is then that we can be able to speak with authority about this issue, because I thought maybe you were going to look at something as legal people that are doing presentation to us to quote something that will be certain to us, instead of making the very same important mistake and shortcoming that they are raising, because we might find ourselves as a committee considering what we are presenting, but considering a case that is still before an SDA and the Supreme Court of Appeal might confirm or maybe come to a different conclusion, and the person can take it to Concord, and Concord would be the one that the final arbiter will assist us, because I thought maybe on that aspect it's limiting us in terms of being broad in our approach to understand the very same important clause that we are raising, so that we can be certain that whatever that we're doing is going to be in line with the Constitution. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And thanks to the presentations. All the presenters are bringing the religiosity perspective on the bill. The first presenter is talking about a reasonable person. Reasonable person. And also equally the anti-religion. And also South Africa belongs to all who live in it, irrespective of their religious affiliation. I just want to check whether there is any harmony with those that are non-believers, those that are not believing to any religion, affiliating to any religion, from the your input, are you accommodating them? Because it appears that those that are not Christian are anti-religions and you cannot welcome them and to work harmoniously with them. I wish there shouldn't be any perception that those that are not religious are the ones that will be perpetrating harm to other human beings. Maybe
chair, because Paul represents us and our perspective are just are all the same. They're repeatedly saying the same thing. Though we are not having other presenters here, which are having perhaps the other perspective, but so far let's welcome it, because we will end up going to the broader society and engage with many others. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I was welcome. Can you give what is your reaction on the comments and questions made? I'm going to take you according to the sequence of your presentation. Unless there's no question or comment that relates to the presentation you made, you can come in. Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure that there was a question directed at us, but if you could confirm, we'd be happy to respond. And that's fine. If there's no comment or question related to you, it's okay. The second presenter can come in.
Thank you, Chair. I'll deal with the issue of our membership first. Forest Island Factor represents religious leaders representing approximately 6 million people in South Africa. Mostly those religious leaders are from the Christian faith. For instance, a large portion of that representation is from TISA, the Evangelical Alliance of South Africa. But in a number of individual churches, congregations from across the Christian spectrum, Pentecostal, charismatic, traditional, and so forth. But then we do work very closely, and we have from time to time worked very closely with also the SA Jewish Board of Deputies on issues, the Muslim Judicial Council, the South African Council for the Protection and Promotion of Religious Rights and Freedoms, which represent about 25 million people in South Africa from across different faith groups. So really a large representation from across spectrum. I don't have all the names of particular organizations and denominations here, but that can be provided on request. That ties in with a question also regarding a reasonable person, anti-religion, and the comment that South Africa belongs to all people who live in it, which is obviously from the preamble of the Constitution, a statement with which we would fully agree, fully endorse. I want to make it plain at this stage that freedom of religion must include and does include the right also not to believe. It's really the right to believe whatever one wants to believe, and to not only believe it internally, but the right to also say what it is one believes, and also the right to live out one's beliefs. And that is what the Constitutional Court has already said in the case of State versus Lauren. But as I said, very clearly it also includes the right not to believe should one choose to do so. And in fact, that is also before his eyes position. There's a well-known quote, it's often attributed to Voltaire, but it's actually not Voltaire, it's somebody else. And it's this quote that says, "I do not agree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to death your right to say it." And I think that would actually sum up Fourier's A's position. I believe that would answer that question. And then finally on the question of, penultimately, on the question of sexual orientation. It is indeed so that the Constitution doesn't specifically mention sexual orientation, but in the application of that section relating to hate speech, that it has been extended to include sexual orientation. In the circumstances, I would contend firstly for the definition that does align with the Constitution, but perhaps to make it more clear, rather than not to mention any specific ground at all, but rather just to generally refer to on the prohibited grounds mentioned in the Constitution. Because I think the moment one starts to highlight a particular ground and leave out some of the others that are mentioned in the Constitution, again, one could fall foul of the Constitution, and there could be complaints, well, why is one particular thing now highlighted at the expense of another? For instance, why is nationality not included? Or why is age not included? Other grounds which are included in the Constitution as grounds that are protected and on which one may not discriminate or perpetrate hate speech. So I think it would be better than just to have perhaps a more general referral to the prohibited grounds, on any of the prohibited grounds in the Constitution. Because as we know, the Constitution doesn't have a hierarchy of rights. It doesn't say that any one constitutional right or any one characteristic is more important, therefore more worthy of protection than another. And I think, therefore, it's important to place them on an equal footing rather than start cherry picking which ones one would want to include and not. And then just finally on the question of Kwilani, it is indeed true that Kwilani at this stage is only pending before the ECA. And it is, and I would commend this committee for being broad in its approach. However, the caution is this, that we cannot be broader than the Constitution. So while we should certainly adopt broad thinking in, to see what could potentially be struck by this definition to make sure that we do include everything we need to include, the Constitution sets the framework for us. We cannot go broader than the Constitution, and that would be my warning. Honourable Chair, that's my comment.
Thank you. You said there's no question and comment connected to your presentation. Let's go to the third presenter, if there's any comment that is related to your presentation.
Okay, just in the first question, there are other legal protections as well, which includes, for example, the Incitement Act, the civil law. I would also draw to attention that definition in the Constitution was not something that South Africa made up, that comes from international documents which we copied into the Constitution. Then the second question, in terms of the Kwilani case, in terms of the possibility of waiting until the Crown Court makes its decision, I'll give two responses. Firstly, that the Crown Court or the SCA could decide either that they to declare that the Equality Act definition is invalid and that it must be restricted exactly to what is in the Constitution, which would then force a change in that, or they could say that the definition is left up to Parliament. If they instruct to force that way, then Parliament would have to go with that narrow definition and change the Equality Act, which I believe would be the right thing to do. But voluntarily, Parliament still has the right to change the definition of in the Equality Act, regardless of what the Constitutional Court says or doesn't say, and also has the right to define what is here in the absence of them having said something, and I believe that would be the right thing to do. Secondly, that was also the opinion that was repeatedly expressed by a much larger number of presenters at the previous 2016 hearing on the same bill, by a much greater diversity of organisation. Then the third question is the question of the harmony with non-believers. I'll give four answers to that question. The first answer is that really, I think we've got to look at all belief systems in a similar category, whether they frame themselves as religious or non-religious. One has to just see them as belief systems, and that all have a similar right to freedom of speech, and that needs to be protected, and there needs to be competition and difference between those views, whether somebody holds an atheistic view or a Christian view or a Muslim view. We need a free opportunity to debate that, as do different political parties need the right to be able to argue with each other. The second argument is that if one looks at the submissions that were in the 2016 presentations to the National Assembly Committee, they were kept busy for, I think, 2 or 3 days with maybe 30 different presenters, and everybody that I heard commenting on the issue of hate speech basically said the same thing: keep it narrow to what the Constitution's definition is. Thirdly, just the question of who has been invited to speak here. I did have a conversation, and I don't want to speak on behalf of somebody else without their authorization, but I did discuss this with one of the other presenters who's not from a religious organization, who was from, also made submissions on this bill, and I wish he was here, or maybe even get him on speakerphone to give his opinion, but he also affirmed the same view that the definition of hate speech should be kept as it is in the Constitution, which is a narrow definition. And then the fourth answer is that we're trying to create a freedom of space for legitimate debate, both religious and political speech, which I think could affect all of you in this room, even if you don't have strong convictions on religious issues, that you would not like it if your viewpoint was then construed as hate speech and you had to waste years in court or to try and defend yourself against that allegation. And so I would argue to keep it as a narrow definition.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. Two questions to cause for justice. As you are in front of a select committee of the National Council of Provinces, you raise the issue of dealing with your senior counsel because we are of the view that there is incorrect taking of this bill. Clarify that one so that we understand it as a select committee. The second one, it's about a serious point that you are raising, that you are of the view that there is an error of law that is being done by parliamentary legal services. I'm interested in understanding these two issues. Why are you saying it has been taken wrong? And elaborate why you come to conclusion that the parliamentary legal services has got a wrong understanding of whether it's the constitution or, but you elaborate so that we understand, so that we can come to our own conclusion as a state committee. Thanks, Chair.
I can give you a chance.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Member, for the two questions. On the first point, you asked about the senior counsel opinion. So, our organisation is a non-profit human rights organisation, and we do public interest work in the legal and the policy-making sphere. So, on our board, we have a number of attorneys. So we are legally trained and skilled individuals involved in the organisation internally. And when we prepared our memorandum of procedural irregularities, that was a decision taken and views taken on an internal level. We have seen during the course of the committee's deliberations and consideration of that these particular issues that there might be some inconclusive view, even from the department side and in relation to how the committee responds to that, about tagging, for example, and the other irregularities. So as a result of that, mainly of last week's meeting, we decided to approach senior counsel to give us external and independent opinion to confirm our views or not. All right, so that's the position just regarding where we are in our own internal process with obtaining senior counsel external opinion on our views. Regarding the error of law question, and I'll answer together with your question on the tagging. So the tagging, we say that if you look at Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which deals with concurrent legislative competence between the provinces and between the national sphere of government, there it is clear that one of the areas in which the provinces can legislate is regarding consumer protection. If you look at what the film and publications legislation is about, it's about protecting some groups, especially children, from being exposed to certain harmful materials and from premature exposure to adult experiences. One of the things where this bill wants to take explicit sexual conduct into the online space, that's obviously a proposal, and there's certain conditions attached to the distribution of adult pornography online, including preventing access for children so that they will not be exposed to this material. But because that has to do with consumer protection, and that's not the only provision, not the only clause in this bill that deals with consumer protection. But looking at that as an example, because that deals with consumer protection, the provinces need to be consulted whether they believe what the bill proposes on how to protect children from gaining access to online adult pornography, whether those proposed conditions are sufficient to protect people within their province, within their constituencies. So that's the example, that's the answer to the tagging question. Then regarding the area of law, and it all deals with a constitutional court judgment, the print media case, which many of you will know, it dealt with specific wording, and it's the same kind of wording that is used in the current section 16.4b of the Act and 18.3b of the Act. It deals with the definition of XX material, right? That is the material that may not be distributed in South Africa at all. And one of the proposals, obviously, in this bill is to water that down, to put a different definition in place and remove what is currently in the Act. That decision of the Constitutional Court has two judgments. One was the majority judgment, and they looked at the wording in the Act, and they said, no, we don't need to pronounce on whether this is vague or overbroad wording. There was a minority of three judges in that judgment that did come to the conclusion that the specific wording contained in the XX definition, although they considered it in a different context, that wording like that would be vague and overbroad. The issue that we have is that when the Parliamentary Legal Services presented to the Portfolio Committee on Communications on this specific legal issue, they indicated to the committee members that the finding of the court was that the wording was vague and overbroad. But that's not how it works, because a majority judgment, that is the finding of the court. And if there are minority judges who express a different view, that is a view, but it is not binding. It's not the judgment of the Constitutional Court. Because the members of the Portfolio Committee were not alert to the fact that they are not bound by a Constitutional Court decision to declare that this wording in the Act now has to be removed and it has to be replaced with something else, they were suffering under an error of law. Not the Parliamentary Legal Services, but the Portfolio Committee members who came to certain conclusions which were accepted and adopted by the National Assembly when they approved the bill before it came to the NCOP. So that is where the error of law lies, is the members of the Portfolio Committee and therefore the National Assembly were not alive to the real question before it. They made a call on incorrect facts, legal facts. And that's the answer to that question.
Yes, the point is made. Let me give the department after the department, as Commander, they will come. That is the purpose and objective why you are here in this engagement, so that you clarify some of the things without responding to every sentence, every paragraph, but give a broader perspective and contextualization of issues. Department, any reaction and comment? Oh, let me first check. Any follow-up question from members? You don't respond to this. Remember, we are policy makers as members of parliament. We are legislators. We do make laws. Yours is to listen, but we are just being fair, just to give you a space to make a comment, and then after that our legal services will come and give their reaction to this. After that we'll close the meeting.
Thank you, Chair. Just to understand it very clear, I just expected to make a general comment, not necessarily responding to each of the submissions that we made. Okay. Well, what I think I should mention, Chair, is that during the time of drafting this bill, we have consulted the drafters of Cyber Security Bill and Hate Speech Bill, the Department of Justice. In fact, in this bill, the penal provisions dealing with the penalty, imprisonment, or that, they were suggested by them. See that the cybersecurity bill and indeed the hate speech bill, they were paralleled before the parliament. We deemed it necessary to consult them, and they gave us an indication as to what should be in our bill so that to avoid a contradiction, to ensure that our bill is in harmony with their laws. So I just wanted to highlight that is telling them to you, Chair. Thank you.
And then that's a good point, so that we don't have a jumble of inconsistencies within our regime of laws. So, yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to all the members in the House at large. The name is Pumelele Nyema, Parliamentary Legal Advice. I think, Chairperson, from your direction, allow me to start with the substance first and then we'll deal with the procedural issues at the end. Chairperson, in respect of the presentations and the crucial points that came about today, I think the main concerns lie upon the definition of hate speech as well as the classification provision. So in that light, Chairperson, may relate to some use of porn and some of the publications that will affect the children. So Chairperson, having said that, I think the gist of the issue lies with Section 16.2 of the Constitution. And for fear of misquoting the law to Parliament yet again, may I just read the specific two paragraphs that the court, the Constitutional Court in the Islamic Unit Convention versus Independent Broadcasting Authority said in respect of Section 16.2 of the Constitution. In paragraph 32, this is what the court said. How is Section 16.2 to be interpreted? The word, the right in subsection 1, does not extend to ... because they didn't include the whole information. Imply that the categories of expression enumerated in Section 16.2 are not to be regarded as constitutionally protected speech. Section 16.2, therefore, defines the boundaries beyond which the right to freedom of expression does not extend. In that sense, the subsection is definitional. Implicit in its provisions is an acknowledgement that certain expression does not deserve constitutional protection because, among other things, it has the potential to impinge adversely on the dignity of others and cause harm. Our Constitution is founded on the principles of dignity, equal worth, and freedom. And these objectives should be given effect too. Paragraph 33. Three categories of expression are enumerated in Section 16.2. They are expressed in specific and defined terms. Section 16.2A and B are respectively concerned with the propaganda for war and incitement of imminent violence. Section 16.2C is directed at what is commonly referred to as hate speech. What is not protected by the Constitution is expression of speech that amounts to advocacy of hatred that is based on one or other of the listed grounds, namely race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and which amounts to incitement to cause harm. There is no doubt that the state has a particular interest in regulating this type of expression because of the harm it may pose to the constitutionally mandated objective of building the non-racial and non-sexist society based on human dignity and the achievement of equality. There is, accordingly, my emphasis, no bar to the enactment of legislation that prohibits such expression. Any regulation of expression that falls within the categories enumerated in section 16.2 would not be a limitation of the rights in section 16. Having said that, Chairperson, I think from what we have heard, we need to take stock of what section 16.2 expresses and what section 9.3 of the Constitution provides, because both those sections are providing the grounds and the prohibited list of things that constitutionally they should not and cannot be done. Section 9.3 is on unfair discrimination, which is unlawful and cannot be accepted and should not be regulated upon. Section 16.2, as I've just read, is also another prohibition on purposes for expression. And I think we need to be then taken back to the purpose of this bill and the context of this bill. We must appreciate that this is not per se a law of general application that speaks to all and everything that should be regulated under, for an example, like your Criminal Procedure Act. If one looks at the Criminal Procedure Act, whatever is said there, it applies to all generally and consistently. But for purposes of this bill, whatever, especially the definition that's expressed in this bill, they are for specific purpose for the feelings and publications work and what needs to be prohibited and what needs to be regulated and what needs to be controlled within the confines of the feelings and publication scope. And that is where we are at, Chairperson. And then having said that, Chairperson, I think from what we see of the definition of hate speech as it stands, I cannot make a head or a tail from the presentations whether the issue is that we shouldn't make reference to 16.2 or whether it's that we are out of scope. I am really rather, I think I need to go back to the drawing board and hear the presentations again, restudy them time and time again. But looking at the definition as it stands, Chairperson, and looking at the judgment that we already have on the Kwelana judgment, which seeks to explain the congruence and the consistency and the implementation and the application between PEPUDA, which is the Section 10 of the Equality Act, which defines hate speech in relation to any other provisions of that act itself. For me, I see that section having encapsulated what is in Section 9 and what is also covered in Section 16.2 for purposes of that act and for purposes to align with the obligations that the Constitution gave to say we need to give an act that provides detail to what equality is all about. And that is the context under which, in fact, that act would be one act as well in a similar stance as the Criminal Procedure Act, which would need to apply generally and consistently for purposes of finding out what is equality, what is discrimination. And if that takes us back to the principle of subsidiarity, that once we have a legislation that speaks to the provision in the Constitution, an attack must go to that act first before it goes to the provision in the Constitution, because the detail is in the act and not in the Constitution. So, Jefferson, having said that, that is the information I just thought we should share. We should share with the committee, and bearing in mind that for our purposes and for purposes of the bill, this is very much a restricted scope of what needs to be regulated upon. And the cyber bill and the cyber crimes that Parliament is currently dealing with, it's a more scope that speaks to all the issues and the crimes and the difficulties or the challenges that the whole public at large would face in terms of ensuring that we go ahead and be aware and be alert and be alive to the fact that the fourth revolution is here. So things are happening faster than we could have ever done. And in this instance, I think for purposes of this bill is really not going as far as the restricting on the religious rights and the religious expression or whatever cultural beliefs and issues that may arise. Hence, even the judgment from Inxeba does, to a certain degree, confirm the view that I'm taking, that we need to be clear on the specific purpose of this act and the specific purpose of this bill, the Films and Publications Amendment Bill. We seek to amend the Films and Publications Act. That distinction must be clear. I think my colleague will take the issue on the tagging just to substantiate and add if there was anything that is outstanding from what we had indicated and what has been responded to today. I thank you, Chairperson.
And your colleague, can you come in?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the issue that has been raised here around the issue of tagging or the classification of the bill, the joint tagging mechanism of Parliament has officially classified this bill as a Section 75 bill, meaning that it does not have to go to the provinces for negotiating mandates. Chair, the term for tagging a bill or classifying a bill as a Section 75 or Section 76 was established in the Tongwane Constitutional Court judgment, and the court stated that for classifying a bill whose provisions in substantial measure fall within a functional area listed in Table 4, then that bill must be tagged as a Section 76 bill. Now, Chair, if you look at the provision, the test is to look at the provisions of the bill entirely and whether in substantial measure they fall within a functional area listed in Table 4. Yes, Chair, there is an area there in Table 4 to the Constitution that is consumer protection. But now the question is, does the bill in substantial measure deal with consumer protection? And what is consumer protection? Is it not an issue of trade or transactions and do children trade or transact pornography? And is the protection, there's some element of protection of children in the bill in relation to pornography, but is that in substantial measure contained in the bill? My view is that it is not shared. Chair, the bill says relating to classification of publications, films, and games, and to regulate online distribution of digital films and games, and also provide for independent industry classification bodies, and also to curb the internet use, Chair, and to prohibit hate speech. That is the main gist of the bill, Chair. Chair, in my view, Chair, my view is that the bill has been correctly tagged as a Section 75 bill because it does not in substantial measure deal with any area listed in Schedule 4 to the Constitution, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
The supreme objective of this is not to duplicate the submissions and the inputs made, but it's part of the whole process of engagement, so that we clarify each other, we engage each other honestly about issues, and we deepen our understanding of the direction that we seek to take. It's not to duplicate whatever, so that we avoid having a desiccated debate and discussion. I think let me give the last chance to the chairperson of the board to have some comment before I close the meeting. After the chairperson of the board speaks, I will request everybody to excuse us, and then members of parliament will remain behind and our legal services. Chair, any comment or remarks?
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members. Chairperson, allow me to let Abongi to say whatever she wants to say on my behalf. Thank you.
Good morning, honourable members. I think as the board, we take the inputs that have been received, and I think they were contained in the written submissions that were provided. And through the department, we have our responses to those, so the committee can consider them. I don't think we want to verbally respond to them now. Just to say that the key objectives of the Film and Publications Act and the Film and Publication Board is to protect consumers, well, it's to protect South Africans, particularly children, from harmful content that was identified earlier. So through strengthening the provisions of the legislation, we will be able to do that more effectively in the digital space, so that we do not in any way infringe on the Section 16 of the Constitution, which talks to the right to freedom of expression. And I think the inputs that were made today were, in essence, talking to that, which is a key objective of the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, for your discipline, for your professionalism, your attendance, your attention, your comments, your inputs. Yes, we had a fruitful engagement, and there are some ideas that we are front loading before this select committee of parliament. You are humbly dismissed. And then we are going to meet FPB on the 10th of October. Our next meeting. So thank you very much. Our legal office of services will come behind.